So, this all seems horrible.
It was bad. It had nothing, no fire, no energy, no nothing.
God help me.
Hello, and welcome to Upon Second Viewing, the podcast where we take another look at our favorite filmmakers' worst-reviewed films and find out what went wrong. But today, we're doing something a little bit different. My buddy Carson Higgins from Filmstruck Film Club will be joining me to discuss our favorite films of the worst-reviewed year of all time, 2020. Obviously, with COVID shutting down cinemas, it was a rather unique year, to say the least, for watching movies, but many of the bigger tentpole releases, they had to be pushed back from their original release dates to 2021 and even beyond in some cases. So we were really just stuck at home streaming most of these movies, which might actually be good news for you at home because pretty much everything we're going to be covering today is readily available for you to catch up with on your couch. Carson and I each came up with our own individual top tens, and we didn't show them to each other beforehand. We were just going to go with it, and if we repeated, so be it. But we were pleasantly surprised, as you'll hear in a minute, that we only had a single movie appear on both of our lists. So along with some honorable mentions, you have at least 19 great movies just from this last year to choose from to catch up with. And we think you're going to enjoy them. This is a long episode, but like I said, we're covering 19-plus films, spending a little time on each one. And like I said, they're all streaming now in your home. So catch up ahead of time before the Oscars and garbage Golden Globes are announced. And you could be ahead of the curve for your Oscar pools or whatever happens these days. Are there even Oscar pools if there's no office to go to? I don't know. So without further ado, here's Carson and I and our 2020 picks for the best films of the year. Hope you enjoy.
JT.
Hello, Carson.
We're here. We've done it.
We're back, baby. It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. The last one you and I did, was it Christmas movies?
Yeah, just before Christmas. Yeah.
That was fun.
And then I don't know if you're keeping up with current events, but.
Oh, what happened?
Oh, you know, just like insurrection and, you know, things like that. So I put a little pause on my podcast for a minute. And,
you know what? So did I, man.
Yeah. Things were a little hectic. And I was like, do I feel like talking about my top five favorite, you know, rom-coms right now? Not really.
But we're feeling good today, aren't we? Today's a good day.
Today is inauguration day.
Yeah, and we're recording on January 20th, 2021. Got a new president. It's a new year.
More importantly, a new vice president.
Exactly.
First female to hold the office.
She's got a bunch of firsts on her little resume. It was such a cool day.
I'm proud of all of us. I'm proud of America.
Me too. And it really gave, I'll speak for you to everyone. Hello, everyone. JT and I were just really excited. We had a good day today. I hope you did too. And maybe if you're listening to this in the future, whatever. We wanted to talk about our favorite movies that we did get to see in 2020.
That's right. And, you know, who knows what tomorrow brings, but for today, pretty good day. So
today, you know,
if you are listening to this during the rapture, you know, thanks for joining us on your ascension to heaven.
Let our buttery voices soothe your ascent.
Yeah. But it's been a minute since we got to see a movie in the theater. I think the last time I saw a movie was maybe March 13th, maybe the day or the day before or the day, 2 days before shutdown. And it was at the Alamo Drafthouse in San Francisco. And I had finished up work and I went and saw First Cow.
All right, Kelly. Hey, Kelly Reichardt's movie.
Kelly Reichardt's excellent film from earlier this year was an early favorite to get some awards at the end of the year. And that's pretty high praise for something that comes out that early in the year. So got that one under my belt. And then they told me to stay the fuck home for the foreseeable future. And here we are, still at home.
I'm about to say something I haven't said in 8 months. I had a AMC A plus. I don't even remember what the hell the thing was called anymore.
The Stubbs.
I had the Stubbs A plus thing, and I actually, my girlfriend and I, Lauren, we had tickets to go see the Vin Diesel film Bloodshot. We were so excited to go see it. And it was the night that the NBA shut down and we were in New York and everybody was just kind of like, it's not time to go out anymore. And, you know, the shutdown basically started that day. And so the last film I saw in a theater, I believe, was either Sonic the Hedgehog. No, it was Onward, the Pixar animated film. That was the last movie I saw in a movie theater almost a year ago.
Yeah. Isn't that a trip? I don't know if we've talked about this, but I was working at a bar and restaurant right next door to the Alamo Draft House in San Francisco. So I was there seeing movies either before work or after work almost daily. Like, you know, I had the Alamo
subscription,
whatever thing. And sometimes I'd just go in there to have lunch because the movies were free. I'm like, I've already seen this. I'll just go in and catch half a flick and grab a burger and then go to work. So that was like part of my almost daily routine, and to have gone this long without seeing a movie in the cinema is it's a weird thing to kind of process.
I will say one of the things I am grateful for, because I think I only saw, I want to say I saw like 4 movies. I was actually like not seeing very many films in the theater for whatever reason. Because, you know, it's that right around the Oscars. So it's like I was playing catch up and making sure I'd seen all the Parasites and 1917s and whatnot. But I am proud that I did get a chance to see in the movie theater Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Oh, cinematography is just incredible.
Dude, it was like, it was one of the most just romantically transcendent experiences I've ever had in a movie theater. And I'm so glad that, like, yes, Onward was good, but yeah, like getting to see like a true piece of cinema before the shutdown is just like, if I never got to see another movie again in the theater, I'd be devastated. But knowing that Portrait of a Lady on Fire was like right towards the end of that.
Yeah.
Oof. It's one of my favorite movies ever, man. And I actually had trouble because I was like, is that a 2020 movie? Because then it's my favorite movie of the year. If it's 2019, which it is, then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, when making this list, I was kind of, you know, playing with that idea like, oh my God, like, do we, you know, consider films that came out in February or March but somehow qualified for last year's Oscars, you know, on this list? Because technically I did see The Irishman in 2020.
Oh, there you go.
But
it wasn't a 2020 release.
No, not necessarily. Yeah. So, right. But another one I did get to see at the Castro Theater at the beginning of the year also, which is a beautiful movie house in San Francisco, a place I do not live anymore.
Oh, well.
God damn you, 2020.
Hey, man. Yeah, I got to see The Irishman on Broadway.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was one of the coolest movie going experiences ever. Oh, look at that. I just said that about Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Turns out I like every movie I go see in the movie theater. Well, bring back the movie theaters, please.
That's a great segue into what we're doing today, which is naming our top 10 movies of 2020. And a good portion of those films were viewed right in our own homes because we weren't allowed to go to the cinema this year for the most part. How did that affect your movie watching experience, the amount of movies you got to see? Do you enjoy having them readily available to you at the click of a mouse, or would you?
I will say, like, there are certain films that I really wish I did get a chance to see the first time in a theater. However, for so many years now, so much of my film intake happens at home that it wasn't that weird, you know, like so often, you know, the Oscars will roll around, something will get nominated that came out in March and it's available to rent or it's available to stream and I missed it. And so it'll be like, oh, I'll watch it now. Or like, if I'm lucky enough to have a screening copy of something, I'll watch it at home. So in those instances, it wasn't that weird. But at the same time, when it's the only option, it really kind of changed, I guess, like what I would gravitate towards. So I watched a ton of movies this year, but most of them were not new.
Yeah.
You know, I played a lot of catch up. I was watching a lot of older films that I had never seen before, things that I hadn't seen in 20 years or something that I revisited.
You're tearing through the Criterion collection.
Oh yeah, baby. I'm burning up that Criterion Channel subscription.
Janus films all day. Giannis.
I should pay them again for how much I use that thing. you can't see this at home, but I'm such a whore for these guys. I have a Criterion beanie on right now that I got for Christmas.
I never take it off anymore. I'm right there with you. I mean, they can't see it, but I have a whole row of box sets just over my shoulder of Criterion special editions. But
one day we'll release the videos of these chats and people can admire your collection. Your very impressive Criterion collection, my man.
Well, thank you. To piggyback on what you were saying, I don't necessarily think that I missed a huge opportunity in not seeing, I don't know. There's some documentaries that came out this year that I don't necessarily needed to see on the big screen that I probably enjoyed more seeing at home. Hmm. But I want to say that there's movies that didn't make my top 10 that might have if I had experienced them in the theater. And the one that just popped into my head was the Borat sequel.
Totally.
Where I'm like,
being able to laugh in a room full of people, like, witnessing all that madness. Laughter. Oh my God.
I know you don't want to say contagious and movie theater in a time like this, but
yeah.
I mean, just, I remember seeing the, okay, so I don't know if I told you this before, but I went on one of those secret midnight screenings of the original Borat when it came, and they were doing it in like 6 locations across the country.
Oh,
like
cool.
A midnight screening. And so we went like 2 hours early to get in line, and the line was already wrapped around the theater. And we're like, oh, we're not going to get in. Mm-hmm. We were the last 4 to get in. So we were in the very front row, and Sacha Baron Cohen shows up as Borat
in front of you.
Right. So we have a front row show, and he like is making fun of people in the crowd and whatever. And this was at the height of like pre-movie, post Ali G show, like excitement for Borat. And the movie was the funniest movie I'd ever seen at the time. And it was because of the theater experience. Mm-hmm. And as much as I did laugh at it on Amazon Prime, and as it obviously needed to come out when it came out, because mm-hmm. half of the movie is about Trump and coronavirus.
Right.
You know, I think we were just robbed of that theater going experience. And I think that did a disservice to the movie, even though I do think it is hilariously funny.
Oh yeah. And a very worthy sequel. I mean, like I prefer the first film, I think, but like, damn, in a world where we get to have a sequel to Borat, thank God it was that.
Yeah. We don't need to spend too much time on Borat, especially if it didn't make either of our lists. No spoilers.
No spoilers. But yeah, you want to get into it?
Yeah, let's get into our 10 best movies of 2020.
Why don't you go first, man?
I'd love to.
Hit it. Why don't you tell the people your 10th favorite movie of the year?
My 10th favorite movie. So I did mention that there were a lot of great documentaries this year. And I think a lot of very important, relevant films related to social justice and important things going on around the world, a lot of depressing things. But the one that really stuck with me the most is a film that came out on Netflix called Dick Johnson is Dead.
Yes.
And it's by a filmmaker, Kirsten Johnson. She did the documentary Camera Person and a bunch of other lesser known documentaries over the years. She does very experimental stuff, not very narrative focused at all. A lot of just lingering long takes. in the in-camera person, she documented her mother who was dying of Alzheimer's and their relationship and, you know, her dying, basically. Whereas in this film, Dick Johnson is Dead, she's documenting her 86-year-old psychiatrist father who is also slipping into dementia and, you know, succumbing to old age. And instead of, you know, kind of wallowing in her grief about watching this, you know, larger than life figure kind of wilt away, she does this experimental film where she stages accidents killing her father over and over. And her father, who is just like the greatest sport in the world, mm-hmm. goes along with it and allows his daughter to kill him over and over, which sounds very morbid, but it also kind of shines a light on this man who's also coming to terms with the fact that he is dying. Mm-hmm. And it brings this into focus for the whole family. And even when he suffers setbacks, which we also see, it's just this weird experimental emotional ride that you go on with this family, even up to a point of a funeral where his friends show up and, you know, not to spoil how it ends, but it's just...
I mean, the title does say...
Yeah, but it goes in places you don't expect it to, and it's just... it's hilariously funny, is the thing, and a very morbid subject, but it's just a beautiful movie and something that it should inspire anyone to maybe ask those questions about your parents while they're around that totally. You maybe didn't think to ask before. Like, do you know when your dad was the most scared he's ever been in his life? Have you ever asked him?
I haven't, but I think I know when it was anyway.
Like, right. Well, I'm just pulling a question out.
Right. No, but yes, you're absolutely that film touched me in a very deep way. 'Cause we had just gone and visited, my girlfriend's uncle who is very, very sick. And so like getting to watch that film immediately after having that experience, was just, I don't know, it was kind of the exact medicine I needed. And I can't think of a better movie for people to watch. Like, right. It's, you know, nobody wants to sit around and talk about their parents dying, but I'm telling you, if you just throw on this movie within the first 5 minutes, you'll know that you're going to be okay. But that you're also really going to be in for quite a treat. If anyone listening to this has seen that movie, you know, and anyone that hasn't should really go watch the trailer, pause this, go watch the trailer for that and come on back.
Yeah. Dick Johnson it's really is good. Dead. It's just a beautiful movie. And on paper, it sounds morbid, but it's just a wonderful experience. So that's my number 10. What about
you? I love that. I love that, JT. My number 10 is something that I don't know would have ever made my number 10 in a normal year. It wouldn't have made my top 10 at all, I don't think, in a normal year. But just given my experience that I had with it and the fact that I've already rewatched it a couple of times, mm-hmm. made me just go, I cannot leave out Eurovision Song Contest Fire Saga.
What is this?
Oh! Okay, so...
Oh, wait a minute. I know what this is.
It's the Will Ferrell, Rachel McAdams. Yes. Okay. Did you watch it?
I did.
Oh, my God, dude.
That came out back in, like, January or February.
It was during the pandemic. I definitely watched it at home. But when it came out, I was just like, well, there's nothing else to do or watch. Like, let's check this out. And I just fucking laughed the whole time. I was so invested in the story. Rachel McAdams, I seriously think, could sneak out a nomination for Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy for the Golden Globes. I really think she could. Like, not necessarily win, but I really think that we might see her get a nomination because she was so good in that movie. I haven't liked her that much since The Notebook, and I liked her in a totally different way because she's hilarious in this. The music, every single song, is just so funny. And like the whole time I watched it with, you know, a couple people, and it was like, is this real? Is this real? This Eurovision Song Contest? And I was like, oh, you don't know? And I would pull up things on YouTube because it's a very real.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like American Idol for all of Europe, but it's a mm-hmm. songwriting contest. And just like the biggest costumes and most wild concept songs. And I think his name's Dan Stevens. He played the Beast in the mm-hmm. Disney live
yeah,
action.
Yeah, Dan Stevens, he's awesome.
He is so good in this movie as this like Russian closeted gay singer guy. And yeah, man, I had such a blast watching this movie. Will Ferrell, it's one of his best movies. I'm saying it, boom.
That's a statement. I will say to your Rachel McAdams note, she is a sneaky comedic actress. Like
big time, man.
Because, you know, people, well, I mean, like when I think of her, I think The Notebook or True Detective Season 2, or things like that, where I'm like, ooh, she's dark. And like,
or Spotlight or something.
Yeah, exactly, like... Spotlight. And then you forget, like, oh no, she was in Game Night, which was hilarious.
Yep. She's great in that.
Yeah. And
what's the one, traveling? There was a time traveling romantic comedy about time or something.
Oh
her
yeah.
And,
where
her and Domhnall Gleeson.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. But
anyway, yeah, she's one of my favorite actresses. I think she's really good. And
yeah, and I did not know this. I was just looking it up, but the guy who directed Eurovision Song Contest directed Wedding Crashers. So,
yeah.
Okay. So it is, it's in the right wheelhouse, you know.
She's great in Wedding Crashers.
So is he.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, I haven't rewatched that since I think probably the night it came out, but I remember really enjoying that. I need to give that a second look.
Yeah, that's like a late night bong and a frozen burrito kind of movie.
Wednesday? Cool. We're in luck.
Sweet. I have both of those things. What's your number nine, JT?
All right. My number nine, I don't know that... Actually, this might be one that sneaks on your list as well. I don't know. This is something that, for whatever reason, when I watched it, it just struck me in a way that I couldn't shake it. And I've seen it now because it's on making its regular rotation on Showtime. Is Judd Apatow's The King of Staten Island.
Hey.
And yeah, for people that don't know, it's semi-autobiographical, co-written and semi-autobiographical of Pete Davidson's life.
Pete Davidson stars
as a fictionalized version of himself, kind of a bipolar, going nowhere, wants to open a restaurant / tattoo parlor. He's just kind of a nobody with, you know, just mental disorders, basically. And his father died in 9/11 as a firefighter. And it's really just a character study of this guy. And I was not a Pete Davidson fan in the sense that I just didn't see a lot of his work. I wasn't really mm-hmm. watching Saturday Night Live when he was a regular cast
member.
I know he's still on the show, but
yeah.
Not when he was like grown to fame. I'm not an Ariana Grande fan. So I wasn't up on my Us Weekly or anything.
Am I saying her name correctly?
Yeah, I don't know. but you know, he was just not on my radar. Mm-hmm. So I didn't come in with any baggage. I just know that people either loved him or hated him. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just give this a shot. And that movie makes me tear up every time at the end. I think it's just so sweet. I think he's a great actor. There are scenes in that take like some real emotional range, and especially dealing with, you know, material that he lived, you know.
Yeah, that was kind of the most impressive part for me, is I'm just like, you're really tapping into some like very vulnerable shit and sharing it with everybody,
and you know, in a humorous take way. Of it.
Yeah, man. And it's like, this is my life. And Judd's over there like, yeah, go, it's going great.
Yeah, I know. Like, but I'm thinking like the scene with his mom on the couch towards the end, where he's kind of coming to terms with how
his dad's death is still affecting him, like, and how he's a messed up person and needs help. And it's like a super vulnerable scene, and he does that two or three times in the film, like with Bill Burr, who's awesome in this.
Dude, so good.
I want him to get a supporting actor. Not going to happen. But
no, but it honestly could. He's good enough to get one, yeah, and it would have been earned. He's very good in it.
Yeah, and I mean, I was rewatching it last week, and there's a scene at the end with Pete Davidson, Marissa Tomei, Bill Burr, Action Bronson, directed by Judd Apatow. I was like, what kind of weird ad libs were someone doing where this happened? But I don't know. It's not the best Judd Apatow movie. You know, it's probably a little long, but there's nothing I would cut out of it. It's just, you know, your typical long Judd Apatow comedy that just struck me a certain way, and I think it's one of his best.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, it's a good one. I'll give you that.
Right. Enough said.
So I got a pretty solid number 9 pick right here. I toyed with putting it up higher because I liked it so much, but it's just a testament to how good this list is. My number 9 is an immediate entry into the canon of Christmas movies. I believe you and I already talked about it, but it was a musical on Netflix that knocked my flipping socks off. Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey. David E. Talbert, thank you so much for persevering. And I don't know if you know this, JT, he was working on that movie for like 30 years.
Yeah, I did read that. This is a labor of love.
Certainly, and like the ability for that movie to make it all the way to getting made and getting made as well as it did. I can't stop listening to that soundtrack, and Christmas is over. And I'm just like, I love Jingle Jangle, man. Yeah. I love it. I love it. I love it. Love it. I love it.
Well, you know me, I am a big Christmas junkie, and Jingle Jangle is going in the pantheon of Christmas movies I see every year. It's excellent. It's just, it's beautifully shot.
It's candy.
Yeah. It's the set design, costumes, everything. Songs, you're right. The music is fantastic.
Music is just absolutely awesome. It was actually really cool. I'm going to plug a buddy here real quick, but I have two friends who do a podcast called Guys Who Like Musicals. Mm-hmm. And they're both Broadway actors who interview people about musical theater and the Broadway kind of lifestyle at large. But they interviewed one of the guys who wrote the music for Jingle Jangle. And it was such an awesome interview. I just learned so much. So for anyone who's curious about that, go check out Guys Who Like Musicals. Look at that. There you go, Dan. Free commercial.
Nice job.
So yeah, there's a bunch of movies still on this list, and we did talk about Jingle Jangle on our Christmas episodes. So just know that if you didn't watch it, you have something to look forward to Christmas 2021, especially if you have kids around. Oh man, Jingle Jangle is just so good.
Yeah, it is. It's excellent. End. And I listen to Christmas music in June. So, I mean, keep listening.
Me too, man.
Well, my number eight. My number eight is one that I don't think you've had a chance to see yet, but I was lucky enough to watch it last week, and it is Promising Young Woman, and it is by a first-time English director, Emerald Farrell, who you might know is on The Crown. She plays Camilla Parker Bowles. Stars Carey Mulligan as a young woman who has
a lot of promise.
She has a lot of promise. She's obviously suffered some kind of trauma in her past, and we find out that her best friend all growing up was assaulted in college when they were in law school together, and subsequently took her life afterwards. And so Carey Mulligan's character decides it is her life goal to exact revenge on not only the people that did this to her friend, but to any male who dares try to take advantage of young women. So she goes to nightclubs on weekends and pretends to be intoxicated till a quote unquote nice guy comes up to help her out. And that's when she flips the script on him back at his apartment and is like, check it out, motherfucker.
I'm wide awake now.
I'm wide awake. It's a dark, I wouldn't even call it satire, but it is very funny.
Like it has a sense of humor about it's, because I have not, like you said, I haven't seen it, but it seems like it has this like viciousness that it like relishes in.
Yeah, it's almost like a comedic girl power American Psycho.
Okay, all right.
But not comparing her character to Patrick Bateman, vibe of the movie where it's just kind of like dark and shadowy a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's probably a bad.
It almost seems like just totally from like I watched the trailer. It seems almost like they took the classic like Death Wish Charles Bronson type movie and just like brought it to 2020 with a young female actor instead. And it's just like, am I totally off base?
No, it's a little poppier than that. I think. One interesting thing that they do is with the casting, especially, is all these guys that she quote unquote helping her mm-hmm. that are really just trying to take advantage of a intoxicated young girl. Mm-hmm. They're all cast by recognizable comedic, like nice Man. Guys.
Great. So isn't like McLovin in it?
Yeah. Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Adam Brody. Sam Richardson, who was in Veep.
The kind of tall, nerdy black dude.
The guy that's very literal about everything. And so these are all the scumbag. Bo Burnham from he's a stand-up comedian, but also did the great Eighth Grade.
Was that last year or the year before?
Year before, I believe. Okay. Yeah. And they're all cast as these scumbags, which kind of gives the impression that, these guys to be these kind, they would never do anything like that. But that's the whole point, is you never really know who's really
the creep
or what people are like beneath the surface. Can't just assume.
Right.
Anyway, it's a whole takedown of that kind of culture and the double standard, obviously, of believing or not believing the victim and giving benefit of the doubt to men in power, white men in power especially. So it's almost a comedy too. So it's got this weird vibe going on that's very much serves what it's doing. And if you're not a complete moron,
you'll pick up what they're putting down.
Yeah, exactly. So of course it's getting it has like an 80 on Metacritic, but a 2 from the users because whatever. Yeah, it's one of those kind of things.
Well, it's one of the ones I'm most excited to watch. So yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that's my number 8. What's your number 8?
My number 8, and we'll see once it all shakes out at the end of the award season and everything. But my number 8 should probably be higher, and I think it is probably like the consensus pick on every list this year. And it was a Hulu original, Palm Springs.
Mm-hmm.
Palm Springs. Andy Samberg, Kristen Milioti, basically doing Groundhog Day in Palm Springs. And it was one of those movies that I saw it being advertised and I was like, yeah, okay. And then I started to hear people, online being like, Palm Springs is so good. One of the best movies of the year. Totally surprised. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. So then I was like, okay, I guess I got to watch it. And I couldn't agree more. It was such a good, for such a kind of tired concept, mm-hmm. right? It was very new, and they breathed a lot of life into that old, waking up and the day is exactly the same all the time. Just the way that their whole relationship unfolds over that amount of time, and just kind of Similarly, like I felt this way, this is weird, but like Leo's character in Inception, how he's like, he's lived so long at this point, he's like 100 or something.
Right.
it's like, you don't know how long Andy Samberg has been stuck in this loop.
Right. And I do like that about it, that the little twists that you kind of pick up along the way feel earned and
totally.
And I have all the information at once.
No, it unfolds very, very organically and in a really satisfying way. And without giving away any spoilers, as you start to get the pieces put together I'm not going to spoil it. It's just like one of the best written comedies I've seen in a long time. I wouldn't be surprised if it gets nominated for original screenplay.
I think a screenplay nomination is within reach for sure.
Yeah. And I think both of them as leads, like Kristen Milioti, I know her because she was in Once on Broadway. And so that's how I know her. They turned the movie Once into a musical on Broadway and she played the girl in that. And so that's how I first got a sense of who she is. And, you know, I think a lot of people probably met her briefly in Wolf of Wall Street. She plays Leo's first wife. So it was just so satisfying. And maybe you saw her in Black Mirror, but like getting to see her really just like own a movie and be the lead. It was just like so nice to be like, oh, you're a movie star and we're all gonna be better for it. I can't wait for you to just work and work and work. And Andy Samberg has just been killing it post SNL. I'm just so pleased and proud of what he's up to. So.
And J.K. Simmons, who's...
Dude, yeah, thank you for mentioning him. He's an exquisite supporting role in this film.
A great foil, too. You know, you just...
Yes.
Every time
he reminds me of the guy in the first Jumanji, the Robin Williams Jumanji, that like guy who's hunting him. That's it. That's all. But so, yeah, man, my number eight, Palm
Springs. That ended up... in my top 20, didn't quite make my top. I got it at number 18.
Cool. But, well, see, that's the nice thing about being me right now is there's so many of the quote unquote best movies of the year that I still have to watch. So my list may change, but right now I'm feeling good about it.
I'm enjoying it so far. My number seven, I had this movie as my number one for about 7 months. And then, you know, all the awards season stuff starts coming out and it kind of dropped down and wound up at number seven, but still happy to include in the list. And that's Gavin O'Connor's The Way Back.
Oh,
with Ben Affleck as an alcoholic former high school basketball phenom who is now just living his days doing construction and drinking at the local bar till he crawls home or occasionally drives home and crashes his car. And he's just on a fast road to nowhere. And his old priest from his high school comes and says, why don't you be the coach? We're trying to give him like a second shot at life. The priest sees something in him and thinks this would do good. And after some reluctance, he decides to come on as a coach. And what I love about this movie is it doesn't go the place that you think it's going to go. Like a lot of these movies, and especially see this with kind of Disney sports movies where there's the eventual rise, then the fall, and then the rise again. And there's the fall, the rise, and then after that, you don't really know where it's going. And it doesn't follow the same path as a lot of these kind of inspiring sports movies take. Gavin O'Connor did Warrior, the kind of MMA film. And before that, he did Miracle with Kurt Russell.
Your fave.
So, my fave, Kurt Russell, for sure. So he's done both aspects where he's done the inspiring Miracle Disney style and then Warrior, which is gritty. And this falls somewhere in between that in tone, but it's Affleck's best performance, I think, period, point blank, done the best Affleck performance. And on just a personal level, who's someone who's gone through, you know, worst times with alcohol and things like that. And I've been sober for over 2 years now. So it kind of, I could relate to a lot of the things in this movie too. So it hit me on a personal level, but beyond that, I think it's a brilliant film. And I'm proud to have it on the list. Number
six. Love that, man. And I'm proud of you, by the way. Happy 2 years. You know, that's thanks, awesome. Man. That's really thank cool. You.
Got my LaCroix pumping.
Ooh, get that pompamoose, girl.
Yeah.
All right.
What about you? What about your numbers? Or did you see The Way Back?
I still haven't seen The Way Back, but I'm, it's on, I think it's, what is it, on HBO now?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, so it's coming up. I can feel it. I'm going to awesome. Watch it soon, especially now that basketball's back on and stuff. I'm just, you know, I'm pumped.
Yeah, get inspired, baby. What's get your inspired. Number seven?
Dude, my number seven is my only, well, let me first say this. I'm a huge sucker for animated movies, and so my one and only inclusion on here is a film that came out on Christmas Day, and I bet you have watched it, and if you haven't, you got to check it out. It's Pixar's Soul. I just absolutely had such a good, what was it, you know, 2 hours or just under with that movie. I've been such a big fan of Pete Docter over at Pixar. He's the mind behind Monsters, Inc. and Up and Inside Out. And now with this movie Soul, it's just pretty clear that, pardon me. Oh gosh, I got a tickle in my throat. But that he's like kind of the best surrealist director in Hollywood at the moment.
Wow, you know what, that's a good call. I mean, we've got your Michelle Gondry's and your, I don't know, does Terry Gilliam still count? It's been a minute.
Totally. Yeah, Terry counts. Fuck it.
But yeah, you're right. Pete Docter, he does some interesting work, for sure.
You know, like, I would love to...
Up was my favorite movie of that year. When it,
dude, it's it, it still holds up, man. I get that little tune stuck in my head every once in a while, that do-do-do-do, do-do-do-do-do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, yeah, if you think about it, like Inside Out and Soul very much feel like they're kind of related. They're cousins in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one's about who we are and one's about where we come from and where we go. But just the tightrope that Pixar and Pete Docter have managed to walk with making movies that are clearly for adults that are also totally for children. it's just, I don't know how they do it. And Soul was such a nice return to form, I thought, for those guys. Pixar has been kind of on that, you know, with the exception of Coco, like just kind of sequel heavy over the last almost decade now. And so getting to sit down on Christmas Day and watch Soul with everything about it, you know, I mean, Jamie Foxx and Tina Fey are great voice actors. The story was awesome. I thought it was full of heart and humor and just a really great imaginative way to explain life and death, where we come from, and when it's all over, where you go.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. So now my number six is.
No, wait, hold on. You're just briefly just. Tell me why I'm okay. Getting the sense that you just did not like it at all.
I did not like it that much.
Okay.
It had its moments for sure. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it was pretty slapdash. Don't know who this movie's for. You said it was for kids. I think this is just a grown-up movie and it's not a very good one.
See, I think it kind of taps into the same part of the heart that like Dick Johnson Is Dead does, where it's like we're dealing with the afterlife, we're dealing with mortality, which is like something that most filmmakers making movies for children try to avoid at all costs,
except for he doesn't die, spoiler alert.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes. Yes.
So it's just kind of like, what lesson did we really learn here?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
Hey,
I got a lot out of it. I got a lot out of it.
You asked.
And I'm glad on. I did. No, and now we can move on. Okay. But yeah, that was my number seven. So why don't you go on in?
Well, my number six is from filmmaker Miranda July, who did Me, You, and Everyone We Know, and some other kind of experimental. She's quirky, I guess. She's her own thing. And her most recent film is called Kajillionaire.
Oh,
and
fun.
It's with Richard Jenkins and Deborah Winger as con artist parents with a 26-year-old daughter, Evan Rachel Wood. And they are grifters, a grifter family. Their entire life revolves around working as little as possible to get by. They live in like a underground apartment that's not really apartment. It's like an old office space that is next door to a soap factory. So there's suds just coming in through their wall like every day at the same time. So they every day they have to like get rid of the soap, and they just live this weird off the grid existence. And the parents, Richard Jenkins and Deborah Winger, have never once in her entire life shown her any kind of emotional affection. She has no idea what of love or affection or to be called honey or anything feels like. She doesn't understand it. So it's really a kind of this strange late stage coming of age movie where this person is kind of being awoken to these suppressed feelings, feelings as simple as joy, which she's never experienced. And it's just very strangely told, but beautifully told. I don't know, meditation on love, really. Huh. And what it means to show love, what it means to receive love. And it's done in just this very unique fashion that Miranda July is just kind of known for. And it's just a unique picture. It's really tough to explain the kind of emotional journey you go on, but it's just brilliant. And Deborah Winger is one of like the greatest all-time actresses, even though she's kind of a, you know, tough case to be around from all reports. Anytime she shows up, she's just brilliant. And she and Richard Jenkins are awesome in this. And Evan Rachel Wood too.
I didn't know what that movie was about. So that's actually, you got me super curious. I want to go check it out.
Yeah, it's—
Because I remember seeing, I think I saw a trailer for it, because I remember kind of Evan Rachel Wood's hair and her kind of deadpan.
Yeah, she's just straight up like Cousin It hair.
Yeah, totally. That's awesome. I got to check that out.
And a great ending, which I cannot talk about, but it all culminates in a climax that is so rewarding and cool. We're gonna have to check it out.
We're all gonna rent it. We're all gonna rent Kajillionaire.
All right. What's your number six?
So my number six is my— I have a documentary on my list as well.
Great.
It was also released on Netflix, and it is produced by the Obamas. And for anyone who has not seen this movie, you must watch this immediately. It is a documentary called Crip Camp. That's right, Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you have to go check this documentary out immediately. It's about a summer camp. I'm forgetting at the moment where it is, but it was a camp for kids with disabilities, and it was run by hippies. So all the counselors are all these hippies, and all the campers are all these people with special needs,
special needs.
And like across the board, I mean, you have people who are like severely cerebral palsy, and people with polio, and people who, for whatever reason, are in wheelchairs. Like anything and everything, you're welcome here. And it takes place in like
it's in Woodstock.
There we go.
Yeah. Or okay. Cool. Down the road.
Great. And it kind of has that Woodstock vibe. I mean, it's all these hippies, and what's great is you have all these interviews of the campers now talking about their time at this camp. And what's really kind of miraculous is that many of the people who met at this camp wound up going and being very instrumental in getting the Disabilities Act signed in Washington, D.C. You can thank them for wheelchair access and elevators and buildings, and that they fought and fought and fought. And there's an extraordinary section of this film where they do like a sit-in, sleep-in at like the California governor's man, I don't remember what, mm-hmm. but it's just like, I was so moved watching this movie, and it was so interesting. There were so many things that I had no idea about, and so many heroic people that I had never heard of. And I just was so pleased that Netflix and the Obamas made sure that I and everyone had an opportunity to find out who these people were and what was going on. And it's just such a divine piece of education and such a great way to get some visibility on some people who have suffered from lack of acceptance from people like us. And,
absolutely.
And we can fix that really kind of easily. And really, I just can't recommend this movie enough.
I wholeheartedly agree. It's on my top 20 as well. And I have a nephew, special needs, and he's now 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you think about when you were a teenager or young and the things that you had questions about but didn't want to talk to your parents about, you know, sex and dating and things like that. And then you don't really think about how people with special needs have those questions too, and mm-hmm. don't have people that they can really talk. They have fewer people than the rest of us have to talk to because they are ostracized and they are totally made to feel left out. And, you know, my little nephew is the smartest freaking kid. It's like insane that the things that this kid knows. But, you know, if he had some place to go to be with other kids like him, that the counselors were cool, and they, you know, so what if they smoked a little weed? They'll sit and talk to you and treat you like a normal person.
Play music and
yeah, and like
go fishing and play baseball. And
you know, I can't imagine that everyone wants to go to a disabilities camp and do the same things that they have lined up for them every year. Maybe they want to like learn. And I don't know what goes on at these camps or how comfortable parents are even sending their children with special needs. Like, this was a very experimental, very
I couldn't help but be like, I'm so proud of the parents for absolutely being like, all right, I'm gonna drop you off here.
Do the counselors know that X, Y, and Z needs to happen every day, whatever, you know? But
they know you're allergic to whatever.
so bravo to the parents for just being like, what's going to be best for our kid. Mm-hmm. Maybe being around, I don't know, other kids and learning about life and having people to ask questions to that aren't the same people he sees all day, every day, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a beautiful film. Yeah. I got emotional during that one for sure.
And on a personal note, my aunt, she's technically my great aunt. She's my grandma's sister, but she has had cerebral palsy her whole life. And so I was fortunate enough to grow up around somebody with cerebral palsy. And so it was always kind of something I was not only aware of, but like had experience with. And so then in high school, my high school was really great with our special ed program. And we had a club called Best Buddies that was really awesome, where at lunch, basically like all the kids in the special ed department would get to hang out with all the other fucking kids, exactly how it should be all the time. And it actually wound up creating a much more fluid kind of social environment for everyone. Like everyone was always around, everyone was always invited everywhere, everyone was a part of everything. So it's just, I feel very fortunate, very lucky that I had that personal education and experience, and then getting to kind of double down on all of it by watching a movie like this. So I can't wait for them to make a like live action version, or like, I'm sorry, a scripted drama version of this story, and like just hire all of the actors that have special needs and that are in wheelchairs, and like,
let's get Todd Solondz to make this film.
It's gonna be great. I can't wait, man. But so, yeah,
you can't say like, you know what? I wish everyone had a special needs person in their life. But I mean, it's
but
everyone could see, experience. Well, I mean, the least you could do is experience this documentary and be like, hey, this is not something that we have to be afraid of. It's just people that are different. Like, yeah, man. They have the same, it's just people. And
we're all the same amount of different. How fun is that?
Yeah, well. It's tough to convince people of that sometimes.
That's okay. What's your top five movie, JT?
Oh my God, we're in the top five.
Bum, ba-dum, ba-ba-ba-bum.
So my number five is Another Round.
It's, ooh,
my first and technically only foreign film on the list. It is by the, oh, let me get my notes back. This is
let
by,
me check my notes here.
Thomas Vinterberg, who did The Hunt, also starring Mads Mikkelsen. That was an intense drama about a teacher accused of molesting his students, falsely accused, and becoming a pariah, unearned pariah of his town. It's an amazing film if you haven't seen it. But this one, a little lighter. It's called Another Round, and it's about four high school teachers who are just feeling like they are not reaching their students, the students are bored, blah, blah, blah. And they read about the findings of this philosopher who says that we were born with a deficiency of alcohol in our system, and that to reach max potential of what it means to be a human being, like creativity, thought, confidence, everything, you should maintain a level of 0.05 alcohol in your bloodstream at all times. So they decide to, in secret, do this experiment while they're teaching. So they have a drink in the morning, and then every hour on the hour have a drink. And to their shock, their students start learning, their lives improve by like a million, they're just having the greatest life, like the ideal life. So naturally, what do? Let's bump it up to, let's double it. Let's go 0.1% all day. And the results are even better.
Oh.
And then.
Until. Right.
And of course, we see how this experiment will railroad your life. But this is not a good idea.
Right.
But it is so well acted, so well written. And it does this weird trick where for half the movie, you're like, these guys are fucking partying. This is awesome. Like, holy shit. I wouldn't say it made me want to drink again, but I was like.
But you were like, I get that feeling. I've had it.
I can appreciate what these fellas are doing. Holy right. shit. And then.
They're on to something.
They're on to something. Like, wow, okay, maybe I should have tried this. And then when things fall off the rails, you're like, oh yeah, that's right, I quit. I get it. Yeah. But anyway, it's a roller coaster, and Mads Mikkelsen, I think, is one of the most underrated actors in Hollywood. You know him from like Casino Royale with the bleeding eye and a million other things. Super
Rogue One.
Rogue One, of course. So yeah, Another Round, my only foreign film of the top 10, but one well worth your time.
It's another one I've been very high up on the list of things I need to watch to catch up.
Absolutely. But
well, cool. My number five pick is, and guess where it came from? Netflix. That's right. Because that's just kind of where we're at.
Movies, yeah.
But this was one that I had been looking forward to, and then it came out and I didn't watch it. And then I heard that it was good, and I was like, I bet it is, and I still didn't watch it. And then I was like, fuck it, I'm finally gonna sit down and watch this. And my mind was absolutely blown. It was more than I wanted it to be. It was everything I wanted it to be. And it was Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago Seven.
Hell yeah. I love that movie.
One of the best acting ensembles put together. I mean, of all men, one of the best all male ensembles in a minute, which I guess is not a new
Sorkin,
thing. Not a,
Sorkin dude, writes we're not, dudes well.
He sure does, man. And also, this was only his second film that he directed after Molly's Game.
Molly's Game, yeah.
So, which is one that I have not watched, but I loved his work with this.
Yes. He was getting his feet wet behind the camera with Molly's Game. Mm. It's good. Mm. It's fine. Yeah.
It's another one where it's like, I want to see it, but I don't ever want to put it on.
It is a great afternoon TNT with commercials movie.
Cool. Good to know.
Exactly what it is.
Whereas Trial of the Chicago Seven, I would say, is not that at all. I'm like, it's riveting, and you should, it'll demand your attention and earn it. But you should give it your full attention, because there is a ton of education to be handed out within this film. I don't even know who gives the best performance. I don't even think it's worth putting them against each other in a competition. I thought that they operated like the old school San Antonio Spurs, man. They were out there passing the ball to each other constantly. And I was just so pleased with getting to watch the volley happen.
Yeah. And even just my second favorite actor, we already talked about my man, Kurt Russell, but Michael Keaton shows up for a cup of coffee, knocks it out of the park and
crushes it
and strolls out of the courtroom. Like he might as well have been chucking a deuce where he's just man. Later bros. That was fun.
Also, Eddie Redmayne's accent deserves praise, because that dude had I had never heard his voice sound like that. And it was so consistent throughout. And I was just like, damn, dude, Eddie Redmayne might be one of the best voice actors in Hollywood.
And well, speaking of another.
And just one of the best actors.
Yeah. And we already mentioned this guy too, but Sacha Baron Cohen, who's getting a lot of supporting actor love.
He is magnificent in this movie.
He's so good. Another guy that can pretty much just do anything.
Yeah. And like, a couple years ago, I would have been like, I always just see Sacha Baron Cohen. So like, it's hard for me to watch him be like acting in something that isn't a big character, like a Borat or an Ali G or something. And he is just totally gracefully walked right into being an exquisite dramatic actor.
Absolutely. He's great.
Dude, that moment when him and Eddie Redmayne's character really finally kind of have their blowout, but then Sasha's character just really like lets him know how much he admires him, and mm-hmm. I was just so pleased with the whole thing.
It's a great film, and one that I put off for a minute too. You were saying that you just sat on it, sat in the queue, and then put it on. And you're like, I should have been watching this. This should be my third time I'm watching.
I should have watched this shit immediately.
Yeah.
And I forget his name. I'm forgetting the actor's name, but he's in Watchmen and he's in a bunch of great stuff. He's the like the Black Panther guy that is like, I shouldn't even be up here. Like,
yeah, his name's like Aldris something.
I don't want to. I'm going to look it up because his name deserves to be said.
It does.
But he's so good, dude. And like just Jeremy all Strong. Those times where he's like, I don't have a lawyer here. Like,
yeah. it's so, and a lot of times when you have these courtroom dramas, especially ones involving race heavily, like they just make me so infuriated.
Oh,
and,
man.
And this did that. I mean, if you didn't already know kind of the outcome of the trial and stuff, I can see where I would be even more furious, but like, they do it in a way, Sorkin writes it in a way where they don't kind of like hammer home the melodrama. They mm-hmm. kind of just present the facts in a, not entertaining way, but in a fast paced, the dialogue just keeps it moving along. No one shuts up.
No, and you know, because it's Sorkin, like that could have been a play.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm sure
the whole thing's in the courtroom for the most part.
It's a 2-hour movie and I'm sure the script was 300 pages long.
Oh yeah, man. But just so we can say his name, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. He plays Bobby Sale in this.
Bobby Sale,
And goddamn, he's just so good. Everyone is so good. I won't be surprised if they win that Best Acting Ensemble Award at the SAG Awards.
Yeah.
Which is like their best picture.
Right.
Wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, Trial of the Chicago 7, my number five.
Awesome, man. Well, my number four is the one where I don't know if this counts as a foreign film, even though half of it is in a foreign language, but it takes place in 1980s Arkansas. And this is Minari.
Mm-hmm.
And it is by Lee Isaac Chung. Not really known for anything big before this, but it stars Steven Yeun, who's in The Walking Dead and last year's Burning, which is a South Korean film that's amazing.
Did you see that?
Oh yeah, a couple times. It's fantastic.
It's great. That's another one that I'm just like, I gotta watch it. It is. Yeah.
That might be one for tonight, man. I might have to.
Oh damn! All right, Burning. There it is.
Burning's incredible.
Cool.
So it's about this family of four immigrants who moved to Arkansas in the 80s and buy a plot of land to start a farm. They're living in basically a house on wheels without steps. It's just they have to boost themselves up to the front door. They have nothing, no money. They left Korea to chase the American dream. And now they're in Arkansas, rural Arkansas, where they don't really speak the language. Everyone at the local church is giving them the side eye. Not even the side eye. Kids are like straight up turned around in pews.
Staring at them. At them
because they've never seen an Asian person before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a struggle. He's never really farmed. The dirt is, they want to grow Korean crops because they think they can like corner the market on, you know, Korean immigrants wanting their Korean crops.
Mm-hmm.
And the dirt doesn't really produce like that. And, you know, there's a lot of things about whether the American dream is really attainable. And then I can't not mention, I'm gonna probably butcher her name, but Yaun Yun Jung.
The grandma?
The grandmother. She's Dude. Getting across the board talk about being best supporting actress. Well earned. She is heartbreaking and
yes.
so good.
Dude.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a really kind of intimate look at the immigrant experience. Like maybe you don't think about it, you know, especially living in big cities like you and I have, and you think of the immigrant experience as buying a small business and operating it with your family 24 hours a day. And that's what immigrants do to make it in America, I guess. That's what they do in the city. But mm-hmm. then, you know, you don't think about out in the rural where you are so isolated and feel mm-hmm. even more alone in a strange land.
Yeah.
It's just really an eye-opening, intimate experience, and it touched me.
Totally.
That's my number four.
I love that. My number four was a film that totally caught me off guard. I don't think I knew anything about it. I was just like, oh, that sounds interesting, and I popped it on, and it blew my mind off. And since then, I've been seeing it on best of the year lists all over the place. It is Andrew Patterson's The Vast of Night.
Yes.
Dude.
Excellent.
Andrew Patterson is a name that we're all going to have to get to know because this is his debut feature film. And by golly, he made one hell of a movie. If you don't know what I'm talking about, The Vast of Night is on Amazon Prime. You should watch it immediately. I found it to be kind of similar to like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, two young kids in like a high school in some middle America place in the 50s, kind of like get a radio transmission of something they can't explain. And so then the whole movie takes place in real time. It's like it's a 2-hour movie that takes place over 2 hours for the most part. And the camera work in this film is mind-boggling.
The long takes,
good, man.
15-minute take. Maybe I'm exaggerating.
But they feel like that. And there's that one in particular in where Yeah, the one in particular, like from the radio station all the way back to the basketball game at the school, where then the camera goes like in and tracking around shot, the basketball game and back out of the gymnasium. I was just like, what the fuck? Yes. Like, how and did even, you do that?
And even the long takes of just the actors acting, like you're
totally
that one where they're listening to like the radio transmission and
there's that just, old lady that they visit who has that stunning monologue with just like all that information that you're dying to get. And yeah, I mean, if you're a fan of sci-fi, it's so good. It is spooky, but it's not scary. Mm-hmm. I think by the end, eerie is a good word for it. By the end, I think it has like a just a really great message. And yeah, man, like
you know what it reminds me of, because this director is very visually, he's a visual director. I mean,
totally. He's got like Steven Spielberg, J.J. Abrams written all over him. I mean, he's you know one of those guys.
You know what it reminded me though of is Dave Eggers, who did The Witch and then
totally
The Lighthouse and but his first The Witch is like something
Robert Eggers Dave Robert, Eggers so not, is the writer
yeah, exactly.
I do that all the time I do I, that
as soon
all
as
the
I
time.
Said it I was like that's not right but yeah Robert Eggers excuse me but he had a very unique new visual style and the dialogue was all in you know old-timey
just the pacing is so tasty
it is you are immersed in
totally,
that
totally man
or
oh and like the sound design like there's like radio static and just like quiet is just like a very affecting
it
so
sounds like
Vast of Night man I love this movie
like the country at night I grew up in the country like in the very rural small town and when I go back to visit, when I go outside at night, if I haven't been there in a long time, I forget that like, oh, this quiet sounds different than the quiet I'm used to. The quiet I'm used to has fire trucks in it.
And sirens in the distance. And
so
honking.
He does that kind of quiet very well in this, but then those little like radio signals or the little static, that just gives you enough of that uneasy feeling that it's a very atmospheric film and just the announcement of a new voice
so I've it's stuck with me since I watched it however many months ago and I don't see it leaving my favorite films of the year list anytime soon. It's one of the best.
It's I agree. Well
dude, we're here. It's top three.
Woo!
Hit it,
well,
baby.
Talk about movies that don't leave you. I got three in a row for you, but we'll start with my number three, which is called Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. So this movie is a bummer, but it's by Eliza Hittman. She did this movie Beach Rats a couple years ago, and
I remember hearing about that.
Maybe 8 years ago, A Lot Like Love. And all of her films deal with young people, teenagers mostly. A Lot Like Love was about addiction. Beach Rats was about homosexuality. And this one is about a young 17-year-old girl who is carrying an unwanted pregnancy. And along with her cousin, they get money together to go from rural Philadelphia to New York, where they can get an emergency abortion because she is in her second trimester, I guess. And basically it's a film about how hard it is for young women to get the care they need when these situations happen. Now there's a lot of politics, I guess, involved in like, it's a tough subject to navigate, especially as a old white man. But I'll just want to talk about one scene really. And the actress, she's relatively unknown. Her name's Sydney Flanagan. And there's a scene where she goes into the doctor to get in New York when she's finally getting her initial interview about terminating the pregnancy. And it's a medium shot on her. The doctor is off screen, so we only see her from about the torso up, and the doctor is interviewing her, just the standard questions going into the procedure, and their personal questions. And it's a long take, about 8 minutes long, and it is some of the best acting and writing, and it's just something that, as a person like myself, had no idea the
extent of the
not only the trauma that these young women must be going through just internally about their situation, but then the things that they have to confront to people they don't really know. You know, sure, they're a doctor, but you just met this person and they're asking you if...
Will you tell me things out loud that you've never said to anyone ever in a row for 20 minutes?
For 8 minutes. And and then, you know, of course, you learn about the hazing and things that she gets in her hometown. And then later you learn that maybe the circumstances of her pregnancy aren't what you thought. And it's a really harrowing experience, but also incredibly eye-opening and really beautiful. The relationship she has with her cousin and the things that they do for each other on this I don't want to say adventure, but this journey is very real. It just feels so authentic and so real, and nothing about it is sensationalized, but it is incredibly watchable in that there's no point that it gets so overbearing that you have to turn away or like, oh, I'm going to walk away from this for a little while. It is tough. It's a tough sit, but it's not, you know, it's not, I can't think of something to compare it to that's really tough to watch, like Irreversible or something.
Yeah. Right. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So it is dramatically intense, but such an eye-opening and important film, and I fully expect to see her nominated for Best Actress, and it to be nominated for a lot of things, and it's on Showtime now too, or HBO, one of the two.
Oh, cool! Okay,
it is available.
Great,
it is available. But it's called Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, which are the four choices questionnaire of how that she gets asked in that doctor's office. So anyway, sorry to bring things to a screeching halt. But
hey, you know what? It's all right, man, because cinema is like that. We deal with all kinds of shit. It's all good.
Don't worry. It goes up from here. But anyway, what's your number three?
Well, my number three has already been visited in this conversation, so I won't take up
our first repeat.
Our first repeat. I'm kind of glad that it's taken us this long, but here we are. Yeah, man, it's Minari. It's so good, man. We already talked about it, and everyone should check it out. But I did want to highlight one thing about it that I found to be really, really cool. You mentioned kind of the alienation felt by this family in this small Arkansas town, and how there's even like the little kid looking, you know, back at them across the pew or whatever. But the thing that I really appreciated with this film, and how it's like, it never goes exactly where you think it's going to go. So like the young son, David, and this kid in question, who's, I think he says something like, why is your face so flat?
Yeah.
They actually become friends and have sleepovers and are cool with each other. And
then you get to his house and the dad's
cool.
Well, no, I was going to say the dad is almost exhibiting the same. It's kind of showing learned behavior, because he's just like, how's your daddy doing with that farm there? What, you know, kind of talking down to him in a way, just like,
well, I saw it a little different, because it felt to me like, you know, he's a man talking to a child that he doesn't know very well. who's new in town and whatever. But I did like that the movie never like takes the bait on like, let's make it about how racist we are in America.
Yeah, totally.
And like Will Patton's character, Paul, who perhaps you would know from Remember the Titans or Armageddon or something.
He's a great character actor. He was also in American Honey recently.
Oh, right on. Yeah,
Where he had the mezcal.
Anyway. He's so good, and he, you know, he plays like kind of a very like high character role in this, where he's, you know, very much by himself a lot, like very like speaking in tongues alone.
Yeah,
he's got that whole
crazy person,
quote unquote crazy person. But something that I appreciated about how this movie handles that character and his function in the story is like, if this movie was about a white family and this movie was made in the 50s and it was black and white, this character would exist as a black guy or an Asian guy, and he would have like weird spiritual practices, and he would seem kind of dumb, but he's got a heart of gold, and he's super loyal, and he would never hurt a fly. And so it's like, at that time, that character is used to be like, see, these others aren't so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Where we've totally flipped it now, and we're using that character to be a white American. So it's like, he's the one who's weird and crazy and has these like crazy,
and also
I can't stop
ostracized.
Using the word crazy, and yeah. also ostracized and gets made fun of for, you know, he walks that cross up and down the place.
He carries a cross.
Yeah. And, but his never ending loyalty and his absolute goodness, and the fact that he isn't used to show that like, oh, of course he took advantage of this family, or of course he stole from them or whatever. And it was like, I've seen this dynamic before in film, but it's some like, you know, Hong Kong fooey Chinaman, or like, yeah. well, Mr. Black guy. And so I was just so pleased to get a chance to see it for once in a different way, but like where no one is getting stereotyped into like a negative place.
Right. No, it's a miracle little film.
It really is, man. It's just like, it is the American dream on display. And I don't know, I felt very proud to be American watching that movie. It was weird.
Yeah, there is a weird sense of American pride you get from it. Even
it's a reminder of what the American dream means to people who aren't fucking born here.
Yes, exactly.
Who aren't jaded by this fucking freedom that we are allowed
to leave their family and everything they know behind, so that they can live in a trailer in the middle of a field. And
I love the kids in it.
The kids are great.
Kids are great. It's so good. Yeah. I've gone on and on. Yeah. Oh, that's no, my number three. It's so good. Everyone go watch it. Don't be surprised when it gets nominated for everything.
I'm glad you mentioned Will Patton. I hope that he gets some love too around award time, because he's a character actor that's been going for so long, and he's always so great.
Yeah, man. He kills it in this. So yeah. Number two. Where are you at, JT? What's your number two?
My number two is an Amazon Prime original. And it's called Sound of Metal, starring Riz Ahmed and Olivia Cooke. And it's by a movie by Darius Marder, who co-wrote Place Beyond the Pines. And this kind of has a similar like dark kind of gritty texture to the drama, I guess is a way to describe it. It's about a heavy metal duo. Riz Ahmed is the drummer and Olivia Cooke is the lead singer. And we learn almost immediately that Riz Ahmed's character is a recovering addict, as is his girlfriend, though I think she still drinks a little. And she is you could tell from her arms and things, she's a cutter. Like, they're both basically two fucked up people that are trying to keep each other alive. And you know, sometimes you need that support. Really, they're just really damaged people, and all they have really is their tour van and their recording studio in their van and a tour set up. So they drive around gig to gig and you know, live in that tour van. And then all of a sudden he goes deaf during a gig, and it's irreparable. And basically he just lost the only thing that was positive in his life. And so he goes to get help at this kind of retreat center, rehab. It's for addicts and for people that need help like that, but also are deaf. And so the him going to that place, they have to separate. She has to go back home. And it's really a movie about learning to be comfortable with yourself, no matter what comes along, about accepting the things that happen to you rather than dwell on why misfortune is happening. You know, it's very much about, I don't know, having faith that things will work out and working to achieve those sort of things when adversity hits. I know I'm speaking in like cliches, but really hard to like put into words all the things that happen in this film. It is an incredibly intense experience, in just that you don't have to be a heavy metal fan or have to relate to like being a musician. It's right. Anything that you cherish in life. Like if I were to go blind, struck blind and could never watch a movie again, that would change
your whole life.
It would. Not that I'm neat. Well, I mean, it would change your whole life and regardless of what you do. You have to just learn how to be a different person.
Well, I mean, it's like anything. If you lose the use of your legs, you know, like your life is changing today.
Yeah, your life is forever. Not what it was yesterday ever again.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just about being comfortable in your own skin and learning to live with yourself and take it upon yourself to want a better life instead of expect a better life or thinking that you can do things to fix your life by just throwing money at it or something. Like, no, sometimes you just gotta roll with the punches, my guy, and ask for help.
Right. Do you think Riz Ahmed's gonna win?
I think he is going to win Best Actor, and I think the gentleman who plays his counselor will win Best Supporting Actor.
Just straight up, like he's going to win?
Yes, he's going to win. His his name is Lowell Racy?
Sure.
Or maybe Paul Racy? Paul Racy, not Lowell.
Oh, that's a P there.
That's a P there. Paul Racy, R-A-C-I. And he was born to deaf parents. And so is fluent in signing. And also is the lead singer in a Black Sabbath cover band that he signs the lyrics while he's fucking thrashing.
I love
and
that.
He works for the Los Angeles ASL Society and is an actor. And I think it is a shoo-in. He's winning for supporting.
Cool.
Actor.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Damn. Well, cool. Yeah, that's sadly another one that I have yet to watch, but is right at the tippy top of my list of things I'm dying to see.
It's a good thing I said a whole bunch of shit about nothing.
Well, but yeah, I mean,
explain anything at all during that.
I appreciate it, man, because I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I'm sure other people are as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic. What's your number two?
So, dude, my number two, I'm so glad to talk about it. It is a recent Amazon release. It is written, it's adapted from his own play, written by Kemp Powers, directed brilliantly by Regina King. Dude, it is One Night in Miami.
Wow.
One Night in Miami, man, is so exactly what I needed to watch right at that moment that I watched it. I, for anyone that doesn't know, maybe you follow the Filmstruck Film Club, little plug there. You know, over the summer we watched Malcolm X, Spike Lee's Malcolm X, and talked about that. And I'm just one of the best reading books, Jesus Christ, that I've ever had the opportunity to read was the autobiography of Malcolm X. So I'm just like fascinated with him in general. And I echo what many people echo when they talk about him, which is that he's not taught properly at all in the American education system. And with many Black icons and civil rights leaders, they are exalted to this iconic godlike status, and we don't get to experience them as human beings. And so in this film, it's Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown are all in a hotel room in Miami after Muhammad Ali wins the title for the first time or whatever. There you go. Did you watch this movie, JJ?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The dude who plays Malcolm X, do you know his name by any chance?
No, I can find it for you.
I'll pop it up here, but like Kingsley Ben-Adir.
Yeah.
He is so effing good as Malcolm. And the thing that I appreciate about his performance is that he did not try to fill Denzel's shoes at all. He just went to the store and bought a pair of fucking shoes that fit him. And it was so revelatory. I was just watching this dude, and like at first, and this was kind of the case with all four of the actors portraying these giants, is it was like, it took me a couple minutes to buy into their portrayals of them. But then, you know, once we get them all together, all I could see were Sam Cooke, Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, and Jim Brown.
I agree. The suspension of disbelief did not have to go very far. I was like, like, this is who they are. Let's ride.
Yeah. And I don't know if have you seen Get on the Bus? The Spike Lee film. Okay. It kind of reminded me of that a little bit, in the sense where we get the perspective of four totally different like parts of this. It's like, you can't put us all in a box, man. And we're all experiencing Blackness in America differently, especially right now.
They did put him in a box, a hotel room.
Yeah.
I was going to say, but much yes. like to your point about it being like Get on the Bus, is that's largely in one
space. Yeah.
Space. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And goddamn, dude, Regina King, what a splendid debut as a director. Just like her handling of actors, her handling of tone. It looks and feels like an Oscar movie.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Which Absolutely. Is like, and it's something that it, and forgive me if I sound any type of way, I'm just going to say this. It's like over the last couple of years, right? There's been a big push for more visibility and more accessibility for people of color in cinema. And specifically when we get to the end of the year and we're honoring films. And I'm always like, well, the movies that always get awards are like biopics, history, based on a book, you know, like there are formulaic things that you can do to go be an Oscar movie. And it's like, if we ask Green Book, if we could just make some more Oscar movies, like we'll get the damn trophies because we're fucking good at this shit.
I mean, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom this year is another one that made my top 20. This One Night in Miami is also in my top 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, the performances, and I think a lot of it has to do with it being based on a play.
Yeah, because it's a fictional event.
This didn't really happen.
No, and I, you know, all these guys did know each other. There's plenty of photo evidence of Malcolm and Muhammad Ali being totally buddies. Them knowing each other is real, but the sequence of events that unfolds in this hotel room and later on the roof of this hotel is imagined by Kemp Powers. And I thought he did such a great job of like giving little history lessons, little nuggets, mm-hmm. like about why these men are important and exactly. why they're lifted up into this greater space. But then each and every one of them was fully allowed to be a human. I was so stoked to see Muhammad Ali just seem like a young man.
Yeah, and they don't
with the world ahead of him.
And they don't shy away from showing their faults too,
or totally, or man.
Calling them out on like
calling them out
when he calls them out on
dude, when Sam's calling out Malcolm, dude, and reverse when Malcolm's calling out Sam.
Sam Cooke being like, oh yeah, let's listen to your oh boy, that's really doing something for the cause, saying yeah, I love right? you, I love you, I love you. And then
yeah.
it shows, you know, after that is when Sam Cooke starts doing his kind of Black Pride.
Change is going to come. Yeah.
Change is going to come. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, if you haven't watched One Night in Miami yet, go enjoy yourself because it's such a treat. And I really, I don't know, you know, when they'll do this, but I really want to see the play.
Yeah, I do too.
And I hope that they continue to produce the play, even though the film's been made, because I'm just like, the thing that's nice about bringing huge humans from real life into like a dramatic setting, like in a theater, is multiple people get a chance to try the shoes on and multiple audiences get a chance to see different mm-hmm. facets of how this person is a human being. And I don't know, I was so thrilled to like witness Regina King just knock it out of the park, and all four of these men are magnificent in it, and it's so well written, and I got nothing but good things to say about it.
I couldn't agree more with everything you said, and I think a lot of what you just said is a perfect way to go into my number one of the year.
Hit it.
Because not only do I wish I could see this live and in person, but one of the stars of One Night in Miami is a featured player in my number one film.
Your number one film is Hamilton?
Is Hamilton.
Is it really?
It is. My number one of the year is Hamilton.
Not kidding me? You're not kidding right now?
I have it written right there.
You have number one Hamilton right there?
Number one Hamilton.
Dude.
And
talk to me, JT.
Well, I had plans to take my mom and sister to see Hamilton in San Francisco in May because it was coming to an end. It's run there at the Orpheum, and I had not seen it live yet. Of course, didn't get to see it when it was $1 million on Broadway, but
no one did.
But yeah, I had not get to experience it, and I never listened to the soundtrack. I didn't read anything about it. I didn't watch any kind of, you know, what I just wanted to go in and experience it the way it was meant to be experienced live in on the stage, and wanted to take my sister and mom to see it because they had never seen a musical performance like that, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And so I was super geared up for it, and then COVID hit and canceled.
Oh, man.
And so didn't get to do that. And then they put it on Disney Plus, and I was cautiously optimistic going into it, you know, because you're going to lose something watching it on television instead of in a house a la Borat, where you don't get to experience right. it with a crowd. And I drank the Kool-Aid fast, man. I was obsessed.
Did you turn it just way up?
Oh, I was obsessed for like a month. I watched it about 8, 9, 10 times, something like that. I was listening to the soundtrack in the car. I was like, it was a trip. I was one of those people, and I
where
had
you were
no
just
plan.
Like, oh shit.
I had no plan to like it as much as I did. And even making this list, I was like, am I really fucking putting Hamilton at number one? Are you kidding me? And then I just looked at all the movies I had in my top 20, and I decided, you know what? There wasn't a better time I had watching a film this year than the 8th time I watched Hamilton.
Wow, man. I'm so amazed to hear you say all this.
And I think that the director of the film, who, I mean, he really just had to put the camera places. Yeah. And Lin-Manuel Miranda obviously is the you know,
shit
mastermind
is the
shit. Of everything. But this director, Thomas Kail, he yep. He did like most of Fosse Verdon, and yep. so he's no slouch when it comes to documenting this kind of musical theater things. There's nothing I can add to the discourse that has already been happening about Hamilton for the last however many years, 3 years.
What's your favorite song? Do you have one? Oh, Dear Theodosia. Yeah, yeah, man.
Dear
goddamn.
Theodosia, I can love you.
Yes, man. Dude, I was so not at all expecting you to have Hamilton
that,
on your list at all, and it's number one.
Dear Theologia, when that plays in my car, I almost start crying.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
like,
man.
It's...
Have you ever heard the Hamilton mixtape where they had like all the famous people come do all the songs and Chance the Rapper does that song?
No, but I'm going to, as soon as
Busta Rhymes is on the record.
What the fuck is happening?
Yo, you need to go listen to the Hamilton mixtape.
You know,
it's not all good, but there are moments that are stunning. Like John Legend does History Has His Eyes on You.
I was going to say, does Busta Rhymes do
Hercules Mulligan?
Oh, does he? That's perfect.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
I was going to say, the other, I think the women in Hamilton are
so good.
Well, Leslie Odom Jr. I think is the MVP, but
and he won the Tony for that, and rightly so. He was fucking astounding.
Deserved. But I think Philippa Sue, who plays
Angelica, or no, she plays Eliza. Eliza. Thank you.
Yeah. I think she's just incredible, and
she is, man.
And Renee Elise Goldsberry plays Angelica.
Yeah. She. Yep.
Just the women in this are incredible. And
yep.
I don't know. There's nothing I can add except for that it's the best musical I've ever seen.
It's definitely the coolest musical ever. That's for sure.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever rode around in a car listening to
a musical soundtrack.
No, not since I was a little kid and my babysitter had Phantom of the Opera on every day.
Yeah, there you go.
But no, dude, Hamilton is perfect.
I'm so pleased that not you. You picked a musical. You picked something from Disney Plus. You picked great choice, man.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? I was victim to the spell. It didn't take much.
Yeah. I hate to. I'm not going to do it right now. But I'm pretty sure I know every single word to the whole show. I could play everyone right now. But I'm not going to. But well, I could.
That's for a bonus app.
How does a bastard orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, drop to the middle of it? Anyway, great choice, JT.
I agree.
Great choice.
I might watch it tonight.
So I believe it. My number one was just hands down. I'm sure you already know what it is, but it was my single greatest, since all of the viewing was at home, barring those couple at the beginning of the year. This was my favorite straight to streaming release that I thought, I'll say all that in a second. It's Spike Lee's The Five Bloods. It's Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, dude.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. Here's the deal, okay? I love Spike Lee, so
me
check.
Too.
And you know, he's awesome. And at the time it came out, it was in the height of the George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery protests that were happening across the country and the world. And like you couldn't have possibly timed out that release. It just happened to be the medicine of the moment. And it really felt like Spike made a Netflix movie because like the way that the widescreen full screen bars would kind of move in from the sides or in from the top or raise to make a full widescreen image once we're finally in the jungle. I just thought that there was some really clever, like, this is for at home viewing, so let's go ahead and make it so. And still, I mean, it would have been incredibly affecting and awesome in a theater, but just like the way that we switch from like, it looks like a 70s movie or whatever when we're in Vietnam. Delroy Lindo is my pick for best actor this year. I haven't seen Sound of Metal or Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but I'm like, Delroy Lindo gave one of the greatest acting performances I've ever gotten to see. Chadwick Boseman, rest in peace, Storm and Norman. If I had it my way, Chadwick would win best supporting actor for Storm and Norman. If I had it my way, Spike would finally win best director for this movie. I mean, like, I don't know what to tell you. I know that you do not feel the same way I do. I know that there are plenty of people who wanted to like it and didn't like it. I know there's plenty of people who wanted to not like it and got what they wanted. But I took my breath away with that whole landmine sequence. Like I couldn't breathe when we had to get the sun off the landmine. I feel like you want to talk.
Oh no, I have nothing to add, and I want to hear. Get it off your chest, man.
Okay, I mean, just like
I'm not looking at you in any kind of way. I'm listening to every word you have to say.
Because, like, here's the deal. There's been so many movies made about Vietnam already, and this one has a very unique perspective. You know, we're getting to hear about Vietnam from four black guys that were in Vietnam and what their experience was like, having to deal with finding out about Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination while you're stuck in the jungle, you got drafted, you're fighting for freedoms that aren't allotted to you, and the mind fuck that must be for people. And no matter who you are, to get drafted into war is fucking horrible. But the perspective that Spike and I forget who wrote the screenplay, he always folds in such wonderful history lessons. He gives those two. There's some quotes in there. Finding about, like, the first guy that died during the Revolutionary War was a black guy. Did you know that? And, like, we show you his face and tell you his name and tell you a little bit about it. And
classic Spike technique.
Oh yeah, and I mean his use of Hanoi Hannah, the like Viet Cong lady on the radio. She is used with such just impact. And and then goddamn, dude, what's his name from Lovecraft Country who plays the son? He was in the Last Black Man in San Francisco. I love this guy. I'm gonna find out his name, because I want to say Jonathan Majors. Thank you. He's so good, man. Yeah. And everyone was good. And I really, really hope, and I know that I must watch Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I must watch this movie, and I must watch Sound of Metal. But goddamn, I want to see Delroy Lindo get honored for his performance in this movie.
I think the nomination is going to be the honor.
And you know what? That's okay.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm so glad that
he will get nominated for sure.
Yeah. I he was so good, man.
The only thing I'm worried about is Chadwick
he's going to get double nominated. Chadwick's getting nominated
and he's going to cancel each other out. And
you think so?
I think Riz Ahmed's going to win Best Actor over Lindo and Chadwick, even though Chadwick, I think his performance is, that would be the one he should win for of the two. But I think people are going to vote for Defy Bloods and not for Best Actor. People are going to go for Best Actor and not Defy Bloods. And then Riz Ahmed and Paul, Racy, aka Lowell, will edge them out on that.
Yeah.
But okay, so you said a lot of things that are going on in this movie, Defy Bloods.
Yeah.
And I agree. Those things are all going on and they're all important. And maybe make two movies, Spike, because I think he is cramming as much stuff in there as possible, which some stuff gets more time than others to kind of blossom to fruition. And I think the last hour of the movie, when it kind of turns to almost like an action flick, it almost turns into First Blood.
Instead of Five Bloods. Kind of like The Expendables a little bit.
Yeah, where that really took me out of some of the stuff that I thought was the first hour of this movie, first hour and a half of this movie is some of the best stuff Spike's ever done.
Totally.
And then the last hour, I think he just lost his way and was trying to squeeze in as much. And let's not forget about talking about this.
Right.
And like, okay, cool. Yeah, Spike, that's great information, but you know, you kind of covered that in Miracle at St. Anna and also
Malcolm X or whatever.
2 hours and 40 minutes. Let's kind of wrap this up, bro. That's not to, you know, wash over the important things.
Yeah.
That everything in this movie is important. It's just that I don't think he gives a fair time to everything. And I think it's overly long. Too many cooks in the kitchen, maybe. I don't know.
If I could go back in time and have a college dorm room, I would have a poster of Storm and Norman in there. And I'd probably offend somebody that came over. They'd be like, why do you have that? And I'd be like, fuck you, because Storm and Norman's the shit and I miss them.
Well, you'll be happy to know that Five Bloods did make my list. Unfortunately, it's my top 50 and it's in at number 49. So
what was 50?
Soul.
Well, dude, we made it. We made it.
We did it. Do you want to give some honorable mentions that didn't quite make the list?
Oh yeah, I mean, there's another documentary on Netflix called My Octopus Teacher.
Oh, that's great.
That I was obsessed with, and I highly recommend. I also really enjoyed the version of Emma that came out earlier this year with Anya Taylor-Joy.
That was the second to last movie I saw in the theater.
Yeah, same. I went and saw, same here, man. I saw that, and then I saw Onward, and then that was it.
Emma and First Cow for me. It was a
yep. And then
crazy weekend.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Trolls World Tour way more than I thought I would.
I liked that movie too.
I fucking laughed a lot, and I loved it.
I was very
me too. And also another animated movie that I also really really enjoyed was Wolfwalkers on Apple TV Plus.
I think that's going to win Best Animated Feature.
It's so good. There's this tree in that movie. They show it quite a bit, but it might be the greatest tree drawing I've ever seen. Not because it like looks very real, but it's just like such an interesting looking tree. If you watch the movie or if you saw it, you're probably like, I know what you're talking about. That tree's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Wolfwalkers is fantastic.
Yeah. And then yeah, those are the honorable mentions I want to mention. Oh no. And you know what? Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay. All right.
I mean it. I had a really good time when I saw it. And Jim Carrey was back anyway.
I'm gonna pass.
That's okay. So any honorable mentions?
Yeah, I got at my number 11, just missing it because I didn't want to do two concert films for my top 10, is David Byrne's American Utopia.
Yes.
Which is on HBO, directed by Spike Lee. I think it's the best Spike Lee movie of this year.
It probably, you know what? You're right. What is it? American Utopia? Is that what it's called?
American Utopia, yeah.
Yeah, dude, I had such a good time watching that.
And then the other documentary I have in my top 20 is Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which is about, some say it's a staged thing, but nothing scripted. So it's this kind of weird otherly documentary about the closing of this dive bar in Las Vegas. And it was filmed, it was made just before the pandemic. So there's like a TV playing CNN in the corner. So you can kind of see where we are in history and like how close we're getting to like,
oh, interesting,
about to change. But for right now, for all these drunks, the world is changing right now because their bar is closing and they're not
going to
hang out with their friends anymore. It's all these people whose lives are basically at this bar. It's a very visceral experience if you've spent a little time at dive bars in your life.
Yeah.
You mentioned a lot of things on my 20. The other couple I wanted to talk about was I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Charlie
Kaufman Netflix film, which was very strange. A lot of people didn't like it. I thought it was pretty interesting. Color Out of Shape, which is the Nick Cage, H.P. Lovecraft, batshit crazy, directed by the guy who did The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh, Jesus.
So it is just wild. They use all practical effects, so it's super like gross like The Thing, but
good.
Very fun. And then Mank, the Fincher film about the making of a film I don't like, Citizen Kane.
You don't like Citizen Kane?
I don't. But I appreciate why it's good. And I was shocked at how much I enjoyed Mank once I sat down and gave it my full attention. The first time I tried watching it, I was kind of like distracted and then was bored and didn't really like, I couldn't follow. Fincher isn't good about holding the audience's hand, you know?
So definitely not.
He's kind of like, here's 12 people. You need to know all their names. And now we're going to this next scene. And you're like, fuck, I don't know who you're talking about. So once you kind of get an idea of who's who and which actor's playing who, then it's, I think, an incredible film. So that rounds out my 20. You might have a pick for your biggest disappointment of the year.
Yeah, I thought it would be interesting to throw in like something that, you know, I was looking forward to this film and then I saw it and it was disappointing. So I wanted to mention.
Shit on it a little bit.
Just shit on a little bit. But what's funny is you just mentioned it.
Oh, no.
It's Mank.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Mind you, I think it's, you know, and Gary Oldman's one of the best there is.
And this I think is Amanda Seyfried's going to get nominated. She's incredible.
Oh, yeah. But I really think it's one of Gary Oldman's very best performances. I love, love, love the sound design and the cinematography. I hate to say it. I appreciate what David Fincher did by making his father's script into a movie, but I just don't think I like the script.
All right. So, I would say give it a second shot, but you know.
I will give it a second shot because I would love to be just so wrong about that. You know, like 20 years from now where everyone's like, Mank is better than Citizen Kane. And I'm like, oh, okay.
I didn't like Mank. Mank landed at number 12 on my list and I didn't appreciate it until the third time I pressed play. So
yeah, as it was coming out, I was convinced that like, oh shit, Fincher is about to win Best Director. It's going to win Best Picture. And then I watched it and I was like, no, it's not.
Yeah, as it checks all the boxes.
It better not.
Hollywood, you know, likes to give Oscars to. But well, then is there something that you're looking forward to that was supposed to come out this year that got pushed back?
You know, I'm even more glad to talk about it right now, given what your number one was. But the movie that I'm most bummed that I didn't get to see in 2020 was In the Heights.
Oh, talk about it.
Because In the Heights is Lin-Manuel Miranda's other musical that won Best Musical and that like really put him on the map and everything. And it is my favorite musical ever.
Oh, wow.
I prefer it to Hamilton, though I can listen to the music of Hamilton maybe more, I guess. But just from a top to bottom show, In the Heights is the better one in my opinion. And I've seen it several times on stage. And so I was just so looking forward to John Chu's version. The guy who directed Crazy Rich Asians directed this film. Anthony Ramos, who is in Hamilton, he plays Lawrence and Hamilton's son.
Right, right.
Right. So he's the lead.
Also in a Crown Royal commercial that plays every
with the Sly and the Family Stone song.
Yeah. Plays every commercial break on NBA. Yeah.
Yep. But so I was just like, I was so excited for that. And then Dune. Those were the two that like I was really looking forward to seeing. And now I have to, they're still coming out. I'm going to watch them this year.
Yeah.
But those are the ones that I was the most disappointed with getting pushed.
Fair. I was really looking forward to David Lowery's The Green Knight
with
Dev Patel.
Oh man, I can't wait to
dark,
watch that.
Super
dude.
Violent. And that dude just makes great movies. He just makes great movies. A Ghost Story.
Oh, cool.
The last one. Oh no, he did Old Man and the Gun. And
oh shit! Okay.
With Robert Redford, and then he did A Ghost Story with Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, which
great.
Is awesome. And then this new one looks.
It looks so rad, dude. And honestly, A24, anything they put out. Did you see Saint Maud?
No, that was the other one that I was going to talk about.
I want to see Saint Maud, dude.
So they got another release there. I think it's they're aiming for June, early June for that.
Cool.
But yeah, I'm looking forward to that one too.
Nice.
All right. I think we...
We did it. Happy 2020 being over. And thank God there were some new movies that we got to see.
The only one we didn't talk about. Well, there's a couple. But the only one that I think we need.
Oh yeah, I can't believe that we talked for 2 hours and didn't even mention Nomadland.
I was gonna say, yeah, that didn't even make. Oh, it made my top 30. Bill and Ted Face the Music.
I still haven't watched it, man.
God damn it, Carson.
I know.
All right,
I know.
Well, the only other Possessor.
Also. Oh, cool. Okay.
Anyway, that's enough movies.
Yeah, there's so many. I hope whoever, you know, thank you for sticking with us and checking out our list of our favorite films of 2020. If any of these films are things that you missed and that sounded interesting to you, you should definitely go check them out.
Absolutely.
All of them in all a row at the same time.
We just gave you 19 in our...
True that. Because what, Minari was the only crossover
only
for us?
Only one we doubled.
And it was in our top three, both of us. So look at that.
Yeah. Not bad. So I guess Minari is the winner.
That's the best movie of the year, folks. dude, I'm glad we did this.
Yeah, they can find you on Filmstruck Film Club as always.
Yeah, go check out Filmstruck Film Club, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. We watch a movie a week, usually classic films. I try to go off the beaten path sometimes. Give us a follow. You know, if you, it's a fun way to use that Criterion Channel subscription. If not just for that one movie a week, you get, yeah, you know, you're getting your money's worth on that.
And you always pick great movies. And for your audience, I'm at Quarantine Film Club on Instagram and Letterboxd.
Yep, and both of us are on Letterboxd. Go find Carson Higgins and Quarantine Film C, right?
Yeah, Quarantine Film C on Letterboxd. That's right. All right, buddy, this is fun. I'm glad we got to do this in a saner country.
Yes. God bless America.
Hey, God bless America.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
It was made for you and me, you know.
Yeah.
And exactly. And immigrants.
And anyone who wants to come. Bring us your tired, your poor, your hungry. We want everybody. Come, please come enjoy this place
help.
With us.
Please send help.
Please come help us.
Yeah. That's really what we're asking.
Yeah.
Send help.
Dude, I love you, man. This
love
was fun.
Too, this was good. Yeah. All right.
Stick around. We'll say goodbye to the people, but I'll talk to you for a little bit longer. Yeah. So bye, everyone. Bye. Thanks for sticking around. We'll have another episode of First Rule of Film Club soon. And
Upon Second Viewing is getting a makeover, but this will be up and I'll explain that to the people too. But
boom. Check it out.
Next time. All right.
All right. Bye. Much love, everybody. Enjoy every day.
's our show. Thank you so much for listening. The podcast is produced by me, JT Sodergren. You can find my movie recommendations and reviews on Instagram at Quarantine Film Club and on Letterboxd at Quarantine Film C. Give both of those a follow. Original theme music for the show by Richie Cunning. Find more of his work on Spotify and Bandcamp. Just search Richie Cunning. You'll be happy you did. We'll be back next time with more mediocrity from our greatest filmmakers, but until then, remember, you're only as strong as your weakest link.